You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Last week, you heard theater producer and historian Jack Vertell share stories of how he didn't want to be an actor, his interactions with playwrights like Lanford Wilson, and the process of adapting a novel into a musical. Well, now he's back to talk about his new book, Broadway Melody, and answer the final five questions in this bonus episode of Why I'll Never Make It. Well, you have written The Secret Life of the American Musical, but you also have a new book coming out. What is this new book about, and what direction are you taking that?
Well, it's a novel, and I never knew that I would write a novel. It's called Broadway Melody, and it comes out in April. And after I finished Secret Life, I thought that an agent said to me, you know, okay, so that book did well. What else do you want to write? You know, do you want to write a biography of someone or a history of something? And I thought to myself, I don't have anything more to say about nonfiction. So my parents were in the theater in a way. My grandfather built Broadway theaters. I have a lot of tales to tell. And I needed a structure to tell them in. And I thought, you know, the best way to do this is going to be to do it in fiction. So this book, Broadway Melody, which is about three ambitious young people in the theater in the 40s or 50s, and it carries them all, it's a romantic triangle, and carries them all the way through to 2016, when they're quite elderly. I was able to present kind of a parade of theater, Broadway theater, Times Square, rising or falling from a glamorous height, being reborn as a kind of tourist attraction. Many, many events in the theater, including the AIDS crisis, of course, the major one in my lifetime. But also the knocking down of the two legitimate theaters to put up the Marriott Marquis Hotel, and a million recollections of things like, I don't know, Pal Joey. There's a tremendous flop that I happen to be a fan of called Nowhere to Go But Up that takes up part of the book. But it's a romantic triangle, and it's just a romantic triangle that someone interested in Broadway might enjoy because it has so much Broadway history and has a lot of real characters in it, Joe Papp and people like that. And also a lot of fictional characters and some characters who are based on real characters, but don't bear their name. And I just think it's an attempt to put what was left after The Secret Life of the American Musical, what was left in my brain about the Broadway theater into a tale, so to speak, romantic tale. And it was tremendous fun to write. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it does.
Now, in the book, were you tempted, or did you go in directions like, well, this is how I wished it could have happened, or this is how I wished I would have done things?
I'm wondering about that. I took a lot of time revisiting a lot of events in the theater that I either had forgotten about or didn't know about in any detail. And I reshaped them and refashioned them to ways that I thought my three main characters could involve themselves and could push the story forward in unexpected ways. One of the women in the story is a young actress, young ingenue, and she has two suitors, basically, one of whom is a trumpet player and one of whom is a spotlight operator. So I wanted to tell the story of how theater really gets made, that it isn't being made just by the actors, it isn't being made just by magic. It's being made by people who go to work every day and do what they have to do. And in trying to tell that story, I used a lot of material from an internally famous person who no one's ever heard of named Red Press, who was not a trumpet player. He was a reed player. He was a saxophone, clarinet, and flute player, who I got to know. And I got to know him when he was about 70. And he died at 99. And he gave me his unpublished memoir of his early years playing in big bands, all the things that he did before Broadway. And that made me want to tell the story from a point of view of what it was like in the 40s, what it was like in the 50s. And so I refashioned the truth that I knew into a tale that I wanted to tell. I didn't stray too far from the truth. I mean, there's nothing in it where you say, you know, that's ridiculous, I hope. But for instance, I created a scene in there was an Actors Equity strike in 1960, which really happened, and which was really solved in a certain way. And I have two of my characters being the ones who solved it. Now, that didn't happen, but it allows the characters in the story to be part of the history in a way that, you know, most spotlight operators were probably not part of that history, but this guy was. And so, yes, there's a refashioning of the truth, you know, print the legend, as they say.
right. But also it sounds like you're incorporating the lessons that you've learned over the years and incorporating them into how these characters evolve and the things that they become involved in.
Yes. It's a combination of things that I've learned, things that I watched other people learn, because it's always a learning process, you know, and you go through. And also the attitudes and confidences and fear of confidence, you know, not having any confidence that I've observed in professionals in the business, and also just people I know whose characteristics I stole from including my own children, to help tell a story. But I think that theater is, people land on Broadway, particularly those that land from farther away, for a bunch of reasons that have to do with, in the case of actors particularly, needing more love than they got at home. Being in situations far from home that were sort of intolerable. I think a lot of gay people from far away, from the Midwest, from the South, come to New York and become involved with theater because it's a world that welcomes them as opposed to a world that reviles them. And many of them don't become artists. You know, we used to think of gay people as being artistic in some way or other. A lot of them are, you know, selling tickets or, you know, managing budgets. And I only single out gay people because I've met so many of them who came to New York to get away from the life that they were really unhappy with. But it's true of everyone, whether it's for psychological reasons or because of oppression of some sort, that people land on Broadway on the run from something else. And then they find a home on Broadway. And then you have this very peculiar, wonderful family of neurotic people who have suffered in some way or other earlier in life, who have joined together to make this thing, to make this industry, to make these shows, to tell these stories. And that's what this story is. It's about three people who get here by circuitous means because they need to be here.
All right, well, let's do these five final questions. Number one, what do you remember most about your first professional show you did?
I just stopped being a critic, and I won't name the show. But I was standing in the aisle with Gordon Davidson watching a dress rehearsal of this musical, a small musical. And he started complaining about, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, we got to cut this. And I thought, oh my God, the people who are putting on this show, the producer who's putting on this show, knows that the show is not working. I always assumed as a critic that by the time of opening night, everybody in the trenches thought the show was great. And that my job was to tell them that it wasn't great. But in fact, what I learned in that first moment was, no, they know they have problems. They know this thing doesn't work. They're all trying to make it better. But maybe it can only be made so much better, not better enough. And that was a real revelation to me.
Yeah, I've done episodes on my other podcast, Closing Night, about shows that had that same thing, like Nick and Nora.
Right.
The creatives, they knew that they had difficulties and problems, but eventually opening night comes and you have to open with something.
Right.
Yeah. So it you just have to put... Yeah,
unless it doesn't.
Right. Unless it never gets there.
I've had a couple of those as well.
Right. Well, number two, how has the industry changed most since when you first started?
I think the way the industry has changed most is that it has become less and less focused on the art at the center of it. And I say that with considerable sorrow and a lot of frustration. I think that the theater owners, the producers, the people who make the shows happen have become more and more focused on trends, marketing, the value of an important title, you know, a popular title, and less focused on is what's on stage new, original, truly what it's supposed to be. And I think it's a real loss. I think you've seen the commercialization, particularly of Broadway. Broadway has always been a commercial business. It's always been a commercial business. But there was a time when many more of those commercial attractions were passion projects for the producers who produced them, the theater owners who often became producers. And I think that that's less and less true. And it's partly less and less true because a more corporate world is making these decisions.
Would you say that that's probably mostly due to the financing of musicals? It's just gotten so expensive to do them, especially on Broadway?
Yes. I would imagine that's the major reason. I mean, when I was a kid, a Broadway musical cost $300,000, which today would be $3 or $4 million. These shows cost $20 million.
Yeah. So they have to figure out a way to make that money back somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or try.
Right.
Or in some cases, and I know of a couple, where they think of Broadway as a loss leader. They know they're never going to make their money back on Broadway, but they have a really marketable title that can tour for years. And so, you know, so of course we're going to lose half the investment on Broadway. That's not the point. The point is you make it back in other places.
Which is an interesting decision anyway, to know that your show isn't going to succeed, but still put it out there because of that Broadway production, then it will have a life elsewhere. That's where
right.
you make the money.
It launches
right.
An enterprise. And when you start to think of a show as an enterprise rather than as a story that you want to tell,
right,
you're
right.
in dangerous waters.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, how long can I milk this particular show, you know,
right.
for X number of years? Yeah.
Right.
Rather than, am I passionate about this story? Do I love this music? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Well, number three, what does success or making it mean to you?
You know, I've always wanted to do what I wanted to do. And this has been true since I was a little kid. I just didn't want to do the things I didn't want. And success for me was defined by being allowed to do the things I wanted to do. It was not defined by money. It was not defined by fame. It was not defined by being number one in my class. It was by being left alone to do what I wanted to do. And I think, weirdly enough, without having figured out how, in a conscious way, I've been allowed to do what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do in the end, I mean, after school and after knowing that I wasn't an actor and after all the other, you know, failures of one kind or another, what I wanted to do was be involved and help to make more perfect shows that I was passionate about, stories that I was passionate about, artists I was passionate about. I wanted to explore a lot of these old musicals that I ended up doing at Encores because I wanted to know what was in that box. Let's open the box and see what's in it. And I've been allowed to do that. And for me, you know, without becoming wildly wealthy or powerful, that's my success. And the weird thing about it is it's really no different than what I wanted when I was in kindergarten. Just leave me alone to do what I want to do. I'll make my own friends. I'll figure things out.
I like that. Well, number four, describe a personal lesson that has taken you a while to learn or one that you're still working on to this day.
Maybe the lesson I've learned, I mean, I know this is true. I don't know if it's that important a lesson, but it's important to me. Is to not leave the room. You know, you can get frustrated. You can have had enough. You can be bored. You can think these people will do this fine without me. I really need this sandwich. But if something is going on, even something that is humiliating to you or people are vehemently disagreeing with you, you got to stay in the room. You can't make things happen if you don't stay in the room. You got to stay in the room. You got to listen, talk. My impulse is to escape, has always been to escape. When the going gets rough, I run in the other direction. And the personal lesson that I've learned in my personal life and in my professional life is don't run in the other direction. Stay in the room. It may be unpleasant, but you know, if you feel awful and you feel humiliated or you feel angry, all those feelings go away after a little while. So to whatever you're feeling, you're not going to feel it tomorrow. You're strong enough to feel it for a while. So suffer. Suffering will not go on forever.
That's so interesting. It makes me think of, we were talking about Hamilton, the song, you know, the room where it happens. The only way to make it happen is to stay in that room and make it happen.
You got to be in the room. Right.
Well, number five, what's the most useful advice that you yourself have received and how have you applied it to your life or career?
I'd like to say nobody's ever given me a piece of advice. I did all this all on my own. But that, I believe, is not true. Well, it's a funny piece of advice. There was a play I championed called Face Value that was written by David Henry Kwan. And we closed it in previews because there was no reason to open it. And I came in the next day and Rocco Landisman said to me, well, now you have to kill yourself. And it was a great piece of advice because what he meant was you don't have to kill yourself. It's just a flop. It's not your funeral. It's just a flop. And I was at a stage in life where I was so identified so closely with what the work was, as if the work was me, that it was like I had closed without opening. And his advice, which he meant in a humorous way to jog me out of my suicidal mood, was you have to let the work be the work. A lot of work doesn't succeed. A lot of things that you try to do turn out to either have been bad at the concept or have been ruined in the process, or for one reason or another, just don't work. And it's not the end of your life. The end of your life only comes at the end of your life. So just get, you know, take whatever time you need and then we'll talk about the next one.
That's great. That's great. Well, Jack, this has been so wonderful to talk to you and thank you so much for sharing your experiences and stories with us.
I'm happy to have done it and really enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you so much for joining Why I'll Never Make It. And don't forget, you can become a subscriber and get bonus conversations by going to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or just look for the link in the show notes. Well, that about does it for me. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions and John Bartman. Be sure to join me next time as we talk more about why I'll never make it.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.